past injustices. The problem is, those who must pay are not themselves guilty parties, and making up for some earlier injustice merely discriminates against another group. This only exacerbates hostilities between groups and ends up working against the desired goal. Falsely and loudly accusing someone of racism or anti-Semitism, if the person is not in agreement with reparations, is the worst form of bigotry. Such hypocrisy has destroyed a lot of people's reputations and lives, and does great harm to any effort to bring people together voluntarily. If reparations are available, it's hardly a surprise that the line of eager recipients grows quickly. Even those who don't qualify under the rules get in line. Many times those demanding reparations were never personally injured. The result is that undeserving recipients demand financial benefits for something they did not suffer from people who had nothing to do with the injustice. It doesn't sound very fair to me. Behavior quickly changes when government benefits are offered. The mere offer of financial giveaways to victims of hurricanes, for example, invites every manner of public corruption. It creates a moral hazard as well. Government financial programs also benefit financial and business interests the same way. It's not only the welfare poor who line up for benefits, whether after a natural disaster or during a financial crisis. Government force, illegally and illogically used to stop all discrimination, results in a multiplicity of unintended consequences, altered behavior, and fraud. Education. It's quite clear that there is no constitutional authority for the federal government to be involved in education, regardless of what the Supreme Court has claimed. Ideally, education in a free society would be the responsibility of the parents or the individual or local community, not the government. There is no constitutional prohibition for states or local communities to be involved in education. And up until the mid-20th century, education was the responsibility of the church, the family, and the local community. In the past 60 years especially, the federal government has become very much involved in financing and directing education at all levels. There is no evidence that quality of education has improved. There is evidence that more people go to college and that the cost has skyrocketed. At the grade school and high school levels, where local schools and parents have ever less control over the curriculum and administration of schools, there has definitely been more violence, more drugs, and more dropouts associated with more centralized control. Competition is helpful in any endeavor, and this is true in education. But near monopoly control over the indoctrination of young people in our public school systems is counterbalanced by homeschooling, private schooling, and education readily available on the Internet. The regulations on starting a variety of alternatives to public schools are extremely tight and keep the market from operating as it might. The effort to provide more competition to the public school system has not solved the problem, though there are always a few who benefit from vouchers, tax credits, and charter schools. Too often, these efforts are unfairly made available and do not eliminate the power of the state to control the curriculum. The best interim option for reform would be to give a tax credit for all educational expenses. Vouchers invite bureaucratic control of their usage and are unfairly distributed. The textbook argument is unsolvable in a government-run school. All social science books are biased toward different viewpoints. Science books are usually more objective and are not influenced by prejudiced bureaucrats. There's no way a book on social or political science can be non-discriminatory and offend no one. It's equivalent to finding a religion satisfactory to all groups. In private schools or home schools, the issue is moot. The decisions are made by the parents and the school operators, secular or religious. Attendees come with the understanding of any particular bias. Problems associated with emphasis on history and politics in public schools will never be solved by electing a new group of book editors who remove one textbook and replace it with another. In the private system, prayers or Bible reading are not debatable issues, and no one's rights are abused. Most people today accept the idea that the Department of Education is a legitimate federal institution. Not too many years ago, however, the Republican Party platform argued for getting rid of the Department of Education. This pretense was removed with the election of George W. Bush in the year 2000. With both Democratic and Republican support, he massively increased the Department of Education with the disastrous No Child Left Behind program. Now, national control of all public schools is firmly a bipartisan effort. It doesn't seem to matter that students, parents, and administrators and teachers generally disapprove of No Child Left Behind. Once an institution is hooked on federal financing, it's virtually impossible to stop the bureaucratic regulations and mandates that routinely follow subsidies. The judiciary hasn't helped matters either. Court rulings on discipline, decorum, and political correctness have intimidated many dedicated teachers and curtailed any creativity they might have. Lawsuits and threats stifle a good educational environment, something homeschoolers and private schoolers don't have to worry about. The founders of this country were well-educated, mostly by being homeschooled or taught in schools associated with the church. In early times in new settlements, the families would band together to hire a teacher to come and teach. Under those rather crude conditions, without palaces in which to teach, the children were taught the classics as well as foreign languages. Today, our children can get through 8 or even 12 grades without even touching on these subjects. But everybody passes. No single child is left behind. Instead, they are all left behind in large groups. Washington, D.C., the only city that Congress has jurisdiction over, has one of the most expensive, most violent, most crime and drug-ridden school systems in the country. And the only complaint Congress gets from District of Columbia teachers and administrators is that they need more money. The current system has driven many state school systems into bankruptcy. Extravagance in building ornate physical structures while neglecting quality education has added greatly to the debt burden of local and state budgets. This is all in addition to the contribution of the huge sums of money eaten up by the federal bureaucracy and the Department of Education, which contributes to the national debt. The NEA, National Education Association, one of the most powerful lobby groups in the country, successfully agitates for not only structural and bureaucratic excesses, it is responsible for teacher salaries and retirement benefits that far exceed those of the private sector. The future obligation to pay all the retirement and health benefits will require a constant inflow of revenues. Many pension funds are not solvent. With an economy that is likely to remain weak for a long time, assuring that the retired teachers will receive their benefits is questionable. This will probably prompt federal assistance in time. When the conditions in the large cities and states present a major crisis, I'm certain the federal government will bail them out with printing press money. The only question then will be the value of the dollars they receive. Even with the mess we have created with our schools, we are not on the verge of undoing our public school system or wisely reforming it. There is no serious effort to deal with the problem of vastly inefficient, underperforming schools. In reality, the whole system may self-destruct by both poor performance and runaway costs. The grandiose structures built by so many government-run schools resulted from the huge subsidies from the federal government financed by debt and outrageous taxes. It's a huge problem to deal with under today's circumstances. The majority of the American people assume the public school system is a sacred institution. We have been told that our free public school education made America what it is today. Soon they will be forced to quit making that claim. Eliminating federal control someday may be achievable. If government schools were maintained by local control, the problem of monopoly control of education for the entire school-age population would be greatly reduced. The owners of the school, could be the local school boards, which could set curriculum and discipline standards and taxes. This solution is not perfect, but it is vastly better than a Washington-based economic czar using the educational system for propaganda, perpetuating the falsehoods of the state and the so-called benefits of a powerful central government. Thank goodness for the Internet, Amazon, and the thirst for truth that no government is big enough to silence. Empire. The majority of Americans, most likely, do not believe we are an empire. They believe we are a free people and enjoy the benefits of living in a democratic republic. Most people do not read the international news. Even wars are only interesting to people at the very outset. But most Americans lose interest after a few weeks. As a result, most people remain blissfully unaware of the activities of the American global empire. These really came home to me on 9/11, when most Americans expressed shock and amazement that anyone would have a reason to deliver a message to the United States in the form of a bloody and destructive attack. Most people ask what we ever did to incite such a thing. George Bush explained that these crazy people must have hated us for our freedoms. Well, it's a bit more complicated than that, to say the least. There are lots of people who hate us for invading their countries, supporting dictatorships, starving people through sanctions, and maintaining an unprecedented military empire of global reach. Truly, the United States is an empire by any definition, and quite possibly the most aggressive, extended, and expansionist in the history of the world. Do we really find it shocking that some people in the world don't like this? Would we, as American citizens, like it if some superpower were doing this to us? The transition from a republican form of government to an authoritarian empire is most often insidious. Yet history has recorded quite a precipitous shift that dated the end of the Roman Republic and the beginning of its empire. The date is etched in history when Julius Caesar boldly marched with his legions and crossed the Rubicon. The rules were clear. A proconsul in charge of a province outside of Rome was not permitted to enter Rome with his troops. The Rubicon, a 29-kilometer river running east and west in northern Italy, was the line that separated the militarily run provinces and the Roman Republic. It was a small river, but a mighty barrier. It provided a symbolic wall of defense against any internal military threat by an ambitious Roman general. But Julius Caesar successfully crossed the Rubicon with his legions and defeated Pompey's effort to defend the Republic. Caesar quickly secured Asia Minor, and within 3 years, the Senate appointed him dictator for life, which was the final blow to the Roman Republic. Cicero failed to save the Republic, but he left a great legacy in his effort and influenced generations to come, including the founders of our own Republic. Though the crossing of the Rubicon is considered the seminal event in the fall of the Roman Republic, militarism had already been in place outside of Rome itself. The destruction of the Republic came as a consequence of the growth and expansion of Roman military power throughout the Mediterranean region. The Romans assumed that as long as the proconsuls and their military forces did not take over the Republican Senate in Rome, the status quo of the Republic would be maintained. Julius Caesar's military genius, his loyal troops, and the material benefits they received through conquest, along with the Senate's forbearance, permitted him to annex essentially all of Europe and part of Great Britain. Eventually, most of the known civilized world became part of the Roman Empire. Some analogies can be made between the fall of the Roman Empire and the problems we face today in America. One thing for certain, though, is that the duration of the American Republic and Empire compared to those of the Romans will be much shorter. Geopolitical events today are moving rather swiftly compared to ancient times due to modern technology, weapons, speed of travel, and communications. The Roman Republic lasted approximately 450 years before Octavius Caesar brought it to an end. The Roman Empire, if dated from time when Octavian was called the Exalted One in 29 BC, lasted until AD 476. Today's military and the CIA efforts are almost totally unrestrained by the U.S. Congress. The extent of our modern-day worldwide empire strongly suggests a similar pattern of the military independence enjoyed by Julius Caesar. Much more sophisticated today, the CIA, along with our military, might have orchestrated military coups against governments we find dispensable. Iran-Contra-type financing is a tool used to circumvent any effort by Congress to restrain clandestine activity that promotes our empire. $80 billion are spent on intelligence gathering to protect the American people without much to show for it. Possible secret financing by the Federal Reserve, with loans and guarantees to our friends to assist empire building, is unconfirmed, but would not be surprising. Money spent by the CIA and other security agencies receives virtually no oversight by the U.S. Congress. When problems result as a consequence, the military is frequently called upon to bring about order, and Congress is coerced into supporting the effort for supposed national security reasons. These efforts have led to a worldwide presence of American troops. The American people have been brainwashed into accepting this for various reasons. Some Americans believe a great danger is lurking and have become convinced that security demands our ever-growing presence around the world. Others, less fearful, believe we are only spreading our goodness and democracy out of a spirit of benevolence. Even if this were true, why would we spread such a message with armed military? Some still believe in a modern-day mercantilism that requires us to protect natural resources, such as oil, for national survival. Too few understand that the much greater threat to us is the deeply flawed policy that condones military occupation and a world empire. But just as the military of Julius Caesar and the empire he forcefully implemented eventually led to the destruction of the 450-year-old Roman Republic, our current worldwide military presence invites the same result. Though it took years for the Roman military empire to be built, it was clear that passing the point of no return was when the Republic was doomed and the empire would reign. The question for us is, have we crossed our Rubicon? Our future depends on a proper assessment and wise discussions as to what actions we should take. History will determine the outcome and the wisdom of our actions. We have only the present in which to decide on our course of action. History and an understanding of human nature should be used to guide us, but they do not provide all the answers. We don't have a geographic boundary to delineate our republic from the imminent danger of becoming an empire. But I cannot conceive how anyone can deny that the American Empire is not in charge of the world today. With the demise of the Soviet Empire in 1989, the United States quickly assumed the role of the worldwide administrator of military power, and the domination continues to expand and grow. Even with the financial crisis and our shrinking wealth and the exponential growth of debt, we remain the economic powerhouse of the world. The dollar still reigns as king for now. We have more military might than all the rest of the world put together. No one dares attack us in a conventional manner. But danger lies within, with our military and our economic excesses and our lost liberties. If we indeed are an empire, is our republican form of government salvageable? If so, one thing is certain. It won't take hundreds of years to complete the transition, as it did with the Roman Republic and Empire. It's more likely to be like the dissolution of the British Empire or the quick disappearance of the Soviet system. All governments reflect the people's attitude. No system lasts that cannot maintain popular support. Welfare and warfare brought us to where we are, and the majority remains enthralled with promises of bliss. Pompey fought a military battle in an attempt to stop Caesar and lost his life for it. Today, we can still resist without a military or violent confrontation. To acquiesce and not resist in any way and escape to another part of the world is not a realistic option for most Americans. To confront the opposition and defend the rightness of the grand experiment in liberty is the only choice we have. I am encouraged by Victor Hugo's frequently quoted assessment regarding ideas and military powers. There is nothing more powerful than an idea whose time has come. We're in an ideological struggle, and one that is winnable, but it cannot be won without addressing the status of the American empire. An empire which requires perpetual war and preparation for war is incompatible with a free society. Those who consider themselves to be opponents of big government and yet have an uncritical attitude toward militarism and war are either fooling themselves or haven't thought enough about the problem. War feeds the growth of the state. The state is nourished on the liberties of the people. The choice is liberty or dictatorship, authoritarianism, republic or empire. The notion that we can cut government and maintain the empire is preposterous. A country that supports preventive war, allows assassination of its own citizens, and endorses torture can hardly be called a republic. We now have troops stationed around the world. Our empire is every bit as pervasive as was the British Empire at its zenith. Though it was based on colonialism, ours is a military client-run empire with troops in 135 countries and with more than 900 bases. It is the atmosphere surrounding empires that prompts a redefinition of patriotism. Those who are critical of the policies of preventive war as an occupation are dismissed as being unpatriotic and part of the Blame America crowd. Interestingly, though, the soldiers who must fight the wars do not necessarily join in this chorus of discontents. There was a time when a willingness to criticize one's own government when it was wrong was the very definition of patriotism. Our foreign policy of interventionism has brought the worst out in those who support the empire. One of the most disturbing incidents was when President George W. Bush made fun of himself at the annual Radio and Television Correspondents' Dinner, May 3, 2004. At this dinner, he had a slideshow mocking his running around the White House pretending to search for weapons of mass destruction, obviously referring to those that were never found in Iraq. To treat with such levity such a serious blunder, some call it a lie, that has caused so much death and destruction is beyond the pale. And those present at the dinner all had a good laugh over it. Another episode of callous disregard for decency relating to foreign policy occurred when negative ads against Max Cleland were run by a bunch of chicken hawks in his 2002 Senate re-election race. Depicting an individual who has lost two legs and an arm in Vietnam as being weak on defense was about as low as one can get in politics. The ad had Senator Cleland's face morphed into Saddam Hussein's, while it implied that Cleland didn't care about the security of the American people because he didn't always vote with President Bush. Some Republicans even insisted that Max Cleland not be referred to as a war hero, though he had been awarded a Silver Star for gallantry in action. It can't get much worse. To this day, it's remarkable that Max Cleland has a positive attitude about life and America, despite the vitriol that's spewed from those who, in the name of patriotism, supported America's aggressive wars. Empires redefine patriotism just as welfare redefines charity. The two go together. The two ideas are but one idea, that the state should be master. When empires are rich, whether by looting the conquered or inflating the currency, the people grow dependent, work and produce less, and enjoy the bread and circuses or their guns and butter, while drowning in consumer excesses, encouraged by moral decay and financed by debt. All this hastens the day of reckoning when the bills come due and the empire collapses. The republic dies unless a new generation is reinvigorated to secure our lost liberties and reject the addictive notion of empire. Empires require the support of the people. In ancient times, glorious celebrations of military victory and conquest unified and were welcomed by the people. Conquering others meant slaves and confiscated wealth from the defeated. This meant less work, more leisure, and personal excesses, and national prestige. A residual of this sentiment persists today. Death and injury are seen as a small price to pay for the benefits of our empire. The endless praise offered to those who serve in the military "Thank you for your service in defending the empire," is a required politically correct salutation to our universal soldiers. No, they never say thank you for defending the empire. It's much more decent. It's thank you for defending our freedoms, our constitution, and for fighting them over there, so we don't have to fight them here at home. Though the wars we fight are now unconstitutional, the military is endlessly praised for defending our liberties and the Constitution. Many on the right who endorse the preventive war mentality of overseas aggression are sincere in their belief that this effort is required to defeat the enemies of liberty. They refuse to see any connection between a policy of perpetual war and the loss of civil liberties at home. They believe their own rhetoric. This deception only facilitates big government, deficits, and the diminishment of individual liberty they say they are fighting to preserve. Tea Party activists will often claim to oppose the system of tax and spend, bailouts, and socialism, but to the extent that they uncritically defend U.S. foreign policy, they are supporting all the policies they claim to be against. To inspire a nation's support and individual sacrifice for a flawed policy requires a dangerous enemy. But what happens when there is but one superpower and no hated enemy with which to incite the people and gain their support for constant militarism? In the Cold War, the U.S. government used the Soviets to generate the people's support of empire building for national security purposes. And throughout the Cold War, the U.S. empire grew, liberty suffered, and the debt skyrocketed. In the past decade, the real wealth of the middle class has declined as a consequence. After the collapse of the Soviet system, a result of its flawed economic system, not a military defeat, instead of our getting a peace dividend, we were introduced to a new enemy, militant Islam, and a new place for building the American empire throughout the Middle East. In order to define our new nemesis, our government needed to schizophrenically flip-flop on previous alliances. Our friend and ally, Saddam Hussein, had to be turned into a Hitlerian monster about to attack us with non-existent nuclear weapons. After U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, April Glaspie, gave him a green light to invade Kuwait over a border dispute and mineral rights, it became easy for the war propagandists to excite the American people into supporting what is a 20-year war in the Middle East, redesigning the Middle East by fomenting civil wars and regime change, and constant turmoil. Why wouldn't Saddam Hussein trust the United States in his military answer to an old conflict with a rival neighbor, since the United States supported him in his decade-long war against Iran? Various special interest groups joined this concerted effort. To create a new enemy against which we can unite, many interest groups came together: oil interests, neocon intellectuals, pro-war Christians, and patriotic Americans convinced that a great danger to our security existed and had to be stopped. Protecting our oil and our military presence around the world to prevent a new superpower from developing was an easy-to-sell policy to the American people. The Republic is on its last legs, and the military approach of brute force is impractical and unsustainable for the 21st century. Though our weapons have become more sophisticated and more numerous, current warfare has changed from state control to stateless resistance, Al-Qaeda and Taliban style, a modern-day form of guerrilla resistance. We are now faced with what William S. Lind has referred to as fourth-generation warfare. The idea is that those who see themselves as defending their homeland can, in fact, compete with the overweening force of a world power with a nuclear arsenal. We have more weapons and spend more money on our military and the sophisticated surveillance technology than all the other nations put together. Yet, after 10 years, we have not located Osama bin Laden, nor have we brought peace and stability to Iraq or Afghanistan. We have spent a couple $1 trillion, and most importantly, sacrificed a lot more Americans than died on 9/11. Nearly 6,000 have been killed, and hundreds of thousands of physical and mental casualties have been sustained, in addition to hundreds of thousands of Iraqi and Afghani citizens only to see the Taliban and Al-Qaeda moving into Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. We have created a very unstable Iraq, now more aligned with the Iranians as we turn control over to the Shiite Muslims. If our threats against Iran lead to a U.S.-Israeli preventive war against her, it will only drive Iran and Iraq closer to a growing financial giant, China. Every time there's a military confrontation, whether in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, or Yemen, even Somalia, victory is reported since so many insurgents were killed, and when examined closely, there is an admission that many civilian casualties resulted as well, referred to as collateral damage. If it was always reported that we killed freedom fighters defending their homeland, which is closer to the truth, the American people would be outraged. In the 1980s, at the urging of Ronald Reagan, the United States supported the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, with which bin Laden aligned himself in an effort to defeat the Soviet invaders and occupiers. They were called freedom fighters. The Taliban is an outgrowth of this organization. It is a certainty that with every death of an Afghan citizen, many more are motivated to join the effort to rid their land of all foreign troops while boosting support for the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and the recruiting of suicide bombers. The longer the wars go on, the greater is the danger to our nation's security and our financial well-being. Americans today, by a large majority, support the Republican and Democratic policy that hinges on fighting the global war on terrorism. But it's actually not a war in the military or constitutional sense. There's no precise enemy. There's been no declaration of war. Terrorism is a tactic of criminals. Terrorism, defined by the United States and international laws, is a criminal act, not an act of war. Nevertheless, U.S. citizens have been conditioned to condone almost any action, including the first use of nuclear weapons against third world countries, to pursue the war on terrorism out of fear that is deliberately generated by those who desire empire and despise liberty. The war on terror is no more a true war than the war on poverty, illiteracy, or drugs. It's a mere metaphor to provide fear and intimidate people into sacrificing their liberties. I have actually heard a member of Congress say it's all justified because the people are too stupid to take care of themselves. Stretching the truth and lying are permissible under the code of the noble lie, endorsed by neoconservatives in order to secure the people's support. Some members of Congress moan a little, but the funds are always made available for fear of being called un-American or a member of the Blame America crowd, and being characterized as weak on national defense. Even imminent national bankruptcy does not persuade Congress to resist the media and government propaganda, promoting constant expansion of the worldwide military presence defending the empire. Supplemental war funding bills are never defeated and are used to add on additional welfare spending. The linchpin of the fear-mongering is the hate and fear that can be generated by providing an explanation of why they hate us and why they, the terrorists, want to attack us. We are told that it's because militant Islam is preoccupied with hate for and envy of Americans because of our freedoms and prosperity. It is not infrequently that I hear members of Congress express their unqualified opinion that it is only the hate-filled Muslim religion that is the source of our problems, and we must pursue the war on terrorism at all costs, even if it does mean preventive war. Some well-known neocons say they have never heard any other explanation than the religious hatred that they claim Islam generates. They stick to their argument that anyone who would suggest that our own policies contribute to suicide terrorism is committing virtual treason. Sadly, many Americans have been conditioned to believe this. Demagoguing, lying, or denying that no unintentional consequences or blowback result from our invasion, occupation, and bombing of other nations, especially Arab and Muslim countries, presents the greatest danger to our security, freedom, and prosperity. In all criminal acts, law enforcement officers immediately look for the motives that may have been involved, Yet the neocons insist that the motivation is solely religious in nature. Those who want to blame only the Muslim religion absolutely don't want to hear or even entertain the thought that terrorist attacks against us are related to the blowback phenomenon the CIA identified many years ago. One group calls terrorist attacks vicious criminal acts against innocent civilians in an attempt to draw attention to injustices for which the perpetrators see no resolution. The intensity of their conviction becomes so great that they sacrifice their lives for a cause they believe in. The horrendous tragedy is that many innocent bystanders are killed on purpose as the terrorists vent their anger and frustration. Presidential war powers, already excessive, are tolerated as our presidents use signing statements on new legislation, written pronouncements issued by a president upon the signing of a bill into law, executive orders, departmental regulations, and abuse of the powers of the CIA and FBI. The constant exaggeration of the dangers that are said to be coming from third world nations that cannot even feed themselves or refine oil nevertheless convince many Americans that it's all necessary for the president, whether a Republican or a Democrat, to keep us safe at all costs. Even ignoring the real cause of the threat from foreigners who want to terrorize us, few want to put the danger in proper perspective. 9 years without a single terrorist attack in the United States, and with innumerable deaths on the highways and homicides in this country, is a lot of misplaced effort to fight terrorism in the Middle East, for which we suffer horrendous casualties and financial burden. It's impossible to make our country safer, freer, and wealthier if we aren't willing to admit the mistake and come to understand how flawed our policies are. This is a far cry from blaming America. Bad policy by a few of our leaders, motivated by ignorance, special interests, and self-serving desires, is not equivalent to blaming the American people. Closing one's eyes to this truth is the biggest part of the problem. The American people have to become informed and reject the bad policies of the few who are driven by the special interests. That's what true patriotism requires, not blind obedience to government-driven war propaganda. For a little bit of reassurance, even with all the bad mistakes that contributed to the terrorist dangers, it is more likely an American will die from being hit by lightning than from a terrorist attack. I recognize this as a dangerous statement to make. Surely there will be someone in Washington who will write legislation to declare a war on lightning. Another way to put this danger in perspective is that out of the 14,000 homicides committed in the United States last year, only 14 were attributed to terrorism. Between 35,000 and 40,000 deaths occur every year on our government-owned and operated highways, with minimal concern compared to the danger of terrorism. Years ago, a member of Congress slipped a laminated quote into my hand that he must have thought I would find meaningful. I paid little attention at first, and unfortunately, I don't recall just who gave me the quote. I placed it next to my voting card and have carried it ever since. The quote came from Elie Wiesel's book, One Generation After. The quote was entitled, Why I Protest. Author Elie Wiesel tells the story of the one righteous man of Sodom who walked the streets protesting against the injustice of the city. People made fun of him, derided him. Finally, a young person asked, Why do you continue your protest against evil? Can't you see no one is paying attention to you? He answered, I'll tell you why I continue. In the beginning, I thought I would change people. Today, I know I cannot. Yet, if I continue my protest, at least I will prevent others from changing me. I'm not that pessimistic that we can't change people's beliefs or that people will not respond to the message of liberty and peace. But we must always be on guard not to have others change us once we gain the confidence that we are on the right track in the search for truth. Cicero lost his struggle to save the Roman Republic and was assassinated for his efforts. Though imperfect in his political career, he left a great legacy known to this day. He heroically refused to join Julius Caesar's betrayal of the Roman Constitution and the rule of law. Caesar's personal triumph was solidified, and he was appointed dictator for 3 years. 2 years later, he was appointed dictator for life and was assassinated soon afterward on the Ides of March. At the age of 60, and in the year Caesar was crowned dictator, Cicero started writing a series of books on history and politics up until that time. Intellectual study for Cicero was every bit as important as politics and war. By this time in his life, especially since the end of the Republic was at hand, Cicero opted for documenting his thoughts on the significance of a republic that honored the rule of law. He wrote compulsively, and once remarked that he wrote more in that short 3-year period, knowing the Republic was doomed, than during his lifetime when the Republic was in place. Cicero would have been remembered for what he did actively as a politician and orator in his effort to save the Roman Constitution and the Republic, but his legacy was sealed for more than 2,000 years by his philosophic dissertations that, once it was clear to him that the Roman Republic was dead, sprang from his effort to reflect on it. We cannot know exactly what tomorrow will bring, nor in what time the consequences of bad policy will evolve, so we must strive for truth and the preservation of those values that we are convinced have benefited mankind. We could be successful and preserve the American Republic as it was intended, giving up the militarism of the American Empire. The odds are slim that they will occur without a bloody reaction from those who wield the power over the military-industrial complex, our political process, the media, our economy, our monetary system, and our personal lives. But regardless, since the principles of liberty are based on morally correct ideas, anything we do to preserve them will benefit mankind. Making progress in promoting civilization is a much higher goal than the limited desire to save the Republic. Technological advances, the consequences of economic liberty, have far surpassed our ability and concerns for understanding the importance of the moral values required to maintain the process. Concentration on our material well-being and neglect of the moral principles that underpin material abundance will result in the loss of prosperity, peace, and liberty. Already the signs are ominous, a sharply decreasing standard of living for millions worldwide. The American Empire is the enemy of American freedom. It is every bit as much the enemy of American citizens as it is of its victims around the world. Envy. Envy is the painful awareness of another's good fortune. It is usually associated with a desire to bring an end to that good fortune through some means. Thus, it is worse than jealousy, which is wanting what another has. Envy seeks to take away what another has out of spite and hatred, and is driven by the desire to destroy. It is an extremely destructive emotion, one that cannot bring personal happiness, and is sure to bring social harm. The exercise of envy only ends in satisfying the kind of lust for bad to come to others. All the world religions condemn the impulse. It is one of the 7 deadly sins. It is something we train our children not to feel. No good can come of it. I raise it in this context because envy is one of the driving forces of redistributionist politics in the United States, an emotion and motivation endorsed every day on the editorial pages. It is the secret motivation behind the unrelenting attacks on the rich heard every day inside Washington, a town whose population includes some of the most well-to-do people in the entire country. The emotion that is behind the attacks on the justly rich and the emotion that such attacks seek to stir within the population is envy. Envy is sometimes called the green-eyed monster. Many religious traditions have given rise to charms and methods for warding it off. That's because the envious will stop at nothing in order to achieve their goals of harming those who succeed, even when achieving that goal is itself personally harmful. Policies driven by envy, such as the progressive income tax and the inheritance tax, do not help society. They gather revenue, but arguably less than would be gathered if all taxes were low and friendly to overall production. But such policies do accomplish the goal of harming people who are rich and successful. There are dangerous social consequences to the private exercise of envy. People fear driving a nice car or living in a nice home because these behaviors might elicit reprisal. So it is in public policy. Policies rooted in envy discourage the accumulation of wealth, punish success, and cause people to pull back from doing great things. People who might otherwise pursue wealth think twice, knowing full well that the force of law stands waiting to crush success. To hate is always injurious to the soul. To hate because another person or class of people has done well for itself compounds the injury. But that is precisely what policies that survive solely to punish people for making money or for living well are really all about. It's been going on for a very long time. It strikes me as a form of institutionalized immorality. Under ideal conditions, our law should elicit from us the best that we have to offer, always appealing to the highest impulses of our nature. Policies that harm people solely because they are winners in life appeal to the lowest impulses in our nature. It is hard enough for people to come to terms with success, especially in a market setting in which superior traits such as foresight and prudence and good judgment really do lead to profitability. We should learn the virtue of celebrating success, or, as the ancient philosopher said, learn to be inspired by the success of others. We should try to emulate success, not punish it. This is the American way, and a major reason for the wealth and success of Americans. It is the same with international politics. We don't have to be number one, and we sure don't have to regard every country that does well, think China here, as a threat to be kicked and punched. In a true market economy, gain does not come at anyone's expense. We can all win together, provided we keep the green-eyed monster at bay. Evolution versus creation. No one person has perfect knowledge as to man's emergence on this earth. Yet almost everyone has a strong religious, scientific, or emotional opinion he or she considers gospel. The creationists frown on the evolutionists, and the evolutionists dismiss the creationists as kooky and unscientific. Lost in this struggle are those who look objectively at all the scientific evidence for evolution without feeling any need to reject the notion of an all-powerful, all-knowing creator. My personal view is that recognizing the validity of an evolutionary process does not support atheism, nor should it diminish one's view about God and the universe. From my viewpoint, this is a debate about science and religion, and I wish it could be more civil, and should not involve politicians at all. Why can't this remain an academic debate and not be made the political issue it has become? The answer is simple. Both sides want to use the state to enforce their views on others. One side doesn't mind using force to expose others to prayer and professing their faith. The other side demands that they have the right never to be offended and demand prohibition of any public expression of faith. Fortunately, in this country, there is no effort to establish any official state religion as has been done elsewhere in the past. Yet in many parts of the world, today theocracies are still being imposed on many people. It is not a mythical threat, and I understand the impulse to resist. At the same time, the past 100 years have also seen secular dictatorships that banish religion in the name of shoring up allegiance to the state alone. I also understand the very real threat of that terrible reality. The real problem comes when the government gets involved in this issue, whether the goal is to push theocracy or merely prayer in a public place, or the opposite goal of crushing all traces of faith expression in public places. One of the silliest questions posed to the Republican presidential candidate in 2008 dealt with evolution. Why should an individual running for the presidency in the United States be quizzed as to whether or not he or she believes in evolution? The question was designed in an attempt for the supporters of evolution to embarrass a candidate who supports creationism, or, if the candidate backs away, an attempt to drive a wedge between the candidate and the religious right. The way the question was asked made it even sillier. It occurred May 3, 2007, in the first presidential debate in Simi Valley, California. The debate was moderated by Chris Matthews and John Harris. One of the moderators called for all the candidates who believed in evolution to raise their hands. At the time, my first impression was that this sounded like a third-grade class exercise. I interpreted raising one's hand as an all-or-nothing answer and as an insult, and didn't bother to answer the question, nor was I called upon to discuss my views. Most of the conflict between atheists and believers comes up because of public schools. This issue doesn't exist in private settings such as homes, homeschools, private schools, churches, and art studios, to name a few. In the private sector, every point of view can find a place, and these ideas are not a threat to others. As Thomas Jefferson said, it does me no injury for my neighbor to say there are 20 gods or no god. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg. In a public school setting, however, it's a major hot-button issue because the school curriculum and all standards of behavior are dictated by the federal government, the Department of Education, and the federal courts. Though the Constitution in no way prohibits religious expression in public places, the modern interpretation of the Constitution, pushed by the evangelical atheists, demands strict prohibition of public expressions of faith. Athletes can't even say a prayer before a sporting event, according to current court rulings. It's hard to understand the great danger in a voluntary prayer, while it's considered no threat whatsoever for a minority to use a government power to impose its views on others. A broad-based tolerance in all directions would go a long way to eliminating many of the problems, but public schools and public places will continue to exist. In a private setting, the owners set the rules, and participants come with an understanding of the rules regarding prayer and religious expression and what one wants to hear about evolution. This still leaves some problems with the possibility that local schools will overstep the bounds of etiquette or will use some textbooks considered to be offensive to one group or another. In this case, the closest one can come to having the owner decide would be for the local school board to make the decision and be subject to public challenge at the polls. The Supreme Court handing down edicts that apply to every single circumstance around the country is not a solution. This will seem to be less than perfect, but it's a far better solution than having the Supreme Court or the Congress dictate proper decorum with regards to religious expression or picking the books our children will be using in the classroom. Universalization of educational standards and curriculum is exactly the goal of those who seek tyranny over liberty. And if they can use an issue such as prayer in the schools or teaching evolution, they'll not hesitate to do it. There is one argument against evolution that deserves consideration. If man is evolving and progressing, why is man's involvement in mass killings of one another getting worse and the struggle for peace more difficult? Government wars and exterminations in the 20th century reached 262 million people killed by their own governments and 44 million people killed in wars. I fear that doesn't say much for the evolutionary process. Executive power. A dictator enjoys unrestrained power over the people. The legislative and judicial branches voluntarily cede this power, or it's taken by force. Most of the time, it's given up easily, out of fear in time of war and civil disturbances, and with support from the people, although the dictator will also accumulate more power with the use of force. Rarely does an elected leader truly resist the temptation to exert power over the people. History shows the lust for power to be a human trait, and Jefferson's argument for binding our leaders down with the chains of the Constitution was his answer to this temptation. The Constitution was an effort to do just that, but when the mood changes and the people become fearful, they allow the eager leaders, tempted by power, to grab as much as they can, seeing themselves as the only ones who can rescue the people. Because the founders understood this, they made an earnest attempt to write a constitution in which the various powers were separate and designed to place checks and balances on all the activities of the government, in order to strictly limit the powers of the president and the executive branch. They did not want a dictator to evolve out of the constitutional republic they were designing. Article 1, Section 8 defines the limited area over which the Congress, and therefore the whole federal government, was granted authority. Without a clear limitation on the powers of the federal government, the Constitution would never have been ratified. To further emphasize the limits of Article 1, Section 8, the 9th and 10th Amendments were added. The debates and the language of the Constitution never suggested that the General Welfare Clause and the Interstate Commerce Clause could even hint at justifying a federal welfare warfare state. Yet over the years, especially since the Great Depression of the 1930s, a modern interpretation was forced on us by our courts and taught in our schools. This meant that the Constitution could be changed at will by the three branches and without proper amendments, since anything called interstate commerce could be regulated without limit, and even martial law could be justified according to the demands of the general welfare. George Bush used his power in near-dictatorial ways, passing the National Security and Homeland Security Presidential Directive in 2007 that gave him near-dictatorial powers in the event of emergency. Obviously, the Constitution is a dead letter under these conditions. The Welfare Clause in the preamble became a license for specific benefits for one group at the expense of another. The Interstate Commerce Clause became a justification for hindering and regulating everything considered interstate commerce. This has been especially the case since the radical ruling in the National Relations Board v. Jones and Laughlin Steel Corporation decision in 1937 concerning the Wagner Act, which permitted the government to regulate every aspect of American labor contracts. Another case, United States v. Darby Lumber in 1941, radically undermined the Interstate Commerce Clause, with a court justifying their ruling by declaring the Tenth Amendment is but a truism and did not limit federal powers. In the past 10 years, the separation of powers between the state and the federal government has virtually disappeared, and the federal government has won. Today, there is a healthy debate and resistance to this takeover, due to the complete failure of everything the federal government touches. The shift of power away from Congress to the executive branch is every bit as serious a problem as the sovereignty being taken away from the states. Clearly, the Constitution made the Congress the most important of the three branches. Today, it's the weakest. Congress was to decide the issues of war, money, and international and domestic trade, laws, spending, taxes, and foreign relations. Today, these issues are the responsibility of the president, essentially without congressional input. For the most part, Congress gave up its prerogatives without a fight. Too many members of Congress in the past century had been taught that for our survival, we had to have a strong executive. This is unfortunate, since it can only be achieved at the expense of the people's liberty. Excessive dictatorial executive powers are the enemy of the liberties that were to be protected by the Constitution in our republic. Indeed, our system of education has brainwashed generations of Americans that our truly great presidents had to be wartime presidents. George W. Bush understood this and welcomed his role in a war he manufactured. To get a more sensible and different perspective on what makes a truly great president, one ought to read Ivan Ilin's book, Recarving Rushmore, Ranking the Presidents on Peace, Prosperity, and Liberty. He shows why the so-called weak presidents should be considered great, and the so-called great ones should be called the enemies of peace, prosperity, and liberty. Since human nature is such, the founders understood that presidents would tend to accumulate power. Even though the framers provided protection from this by placing maximum authority in the legislative branch, the extent to which Congress has relinquished to the executive is startling. We now have an executive that decides on war and the Congress acquiesces. After Vietnam, Many people demanded restraint on a president pursuing war without congressional approval and declaration. Passage of the War Powers Resolution of 1972 was intended to help, but as so often occurs, a problem to be solved only offers opportunity to those who created the problem to gain even more power. Instead of restraining the president, the War Powers Resolution actually gave him authority to pursue war for 90 days without congressional approval. The only problem is that a war of 90 days is virtually impossible to stop. The war promoters scream that to do so is unpatriotic, un-American, and not supporting the troops. Since World War II, all our wars have been fought without a congressional declaration of war. It's the president who decides, and the Congress that submits with appropriating the funds demanded. This presidential authority was never intended by the Constitution. Today, trade policy has been taken over by the executive branch, and Congress graciously cedes this power. Transferring authority under fast-track legislation defies the intent of the Constitution. Trade treaties are not entered into, since senatorial approval by two-thirds would be required and more difficult to pass. This has led to international trade agreements such as WTO, NAFTA, and CAFTA that sacrifice national sovereignty to international government organizations. These agreements can supersede state laws as well. The Constitution assigns to the Congress the responsibility of regulating foreign trade. If the people and the Congress prefer that the President and international government entities control trade, the Constitution should have been amended. Ignoring the Constitution on these issues, or any issue, serves to undermine constitutional legitimacy. The executive branch, whether headed by a Republican or a Democrat, never hesitates to use the various tools granted or allowed by the neglectful Congress. Executive orders today represent far more than the narrow understanding by our early presidents. Writing an executive order to carry out a constitutional duty is a far cry from using executive orders for the sole purpose of writing laws while circumventing the Congress. During the impasse over abortion during the medical care reform debate in 2009, President Obama solved the problem by writing an executive order and ignoring Congress. Paul Begala's cocky statement regarding executive orders says it all. Stroke of the pen, law of the land, kind of cool. Though executive orders shouldn't be the law of the land, let there be no doubt that law enforcement agencies and the regulating arm of the bureaucracy treat them as such. Statements signed by presidents clarify or put all Americans on notice as to exactly how they intend to carry out Congress's rules. Executive orders have been around for quite a while and used by both Democrats and Republicans. They have been used much more extensively since the George W. Bush administration in the legislation following 9/11. Agencies under control of the executive branch have been writing regulations for decades. Congress prompts the process and ignores the constitutional directive for its responsibility to write the laws. Not only does the executive usurp this congressional prerogative, the agencies become both the policeman and the judge in a monstrous system of administrative justice. In this system, the citizen is considered guilty until proven innocent. Usually, the average citizen is unable to afford legal counsel to defend himself. Citizens just grin and bear it and pay the penalty as the government bureaucrats swell their ranks with constant pay raises and the job security. The war powers assumed by presidents during periods of conflict may well be the most dangerous assumption of power by the executive branch. Once our president gets us into a war, even those undeclared, the routine expansion of emergency judicial powers follows. Though this has happened in all our wars, for the most part, when declared wars ended with the defeat of the enemy, the violation of civil liberties by over-energetic presidents tended to return to pre-war conditions with an improvement in the protection of civil liberties. Economic controls are much more easily imposed under a declared emergency. Roosevelt, Truman, and Nixon all ordered wage and price controls. Nixon did it by executive order due to price inflation of the 1970s, which was a consequence of the guns and the butter philosophy of the 1960s. With aggressive use and the distorted view of wartime presidential powers after 9/11, George W. Bush established a new precedent for arbitrarily increasing presidential powers. Though the war was not a declared war and terrorism is but a tactic used by desperate people for a variety of reasons, it became necessary to talk incessantly about the war on terror, claiming that the war justified the powers he assumed. There's been no sign that the Obama administration is reversing this dangerous trend, and there's no sign that the Congress will restrain this usurpation of powers by the president. The Supreme Court in 1953 set a precedent in the United States v. Reynolds case for current presidential abuse of their constitutionally limited powers. This ruling allowed the executive branch to claim state secret privileges as a reason for keeping any and all secrets it claimed, even without showing the evidence, would threaten national security. President Obama now uses this precedent to hold suspects indefinitely and without charges being made. The state's secrecy provision was also used by the Bush administration to massively expand executive powers. The Freedom of Information Act has not limited this court-approved power, and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act has increased the dangers of runaway executive powers in the post-9/11 era. Today, the executive branch can ignore a civil trial verdict of innocence if the administration still deems the individual a threat and the individual can be thrown in prison indefinitely. Thus, the executive branch has encroached on judicial powers as well. Any individual, including an American citizen, that the president considers a threat can actually be targeted for assassination as we discussed earlier. No charges made, no trial held, no rights guaranteed. This is extremely bad news for the future of the American Republic. But more often, individuals can be arrested and held indefinitely without charges being made. The right of habeas corpus is no longer guaranteed. The reason given is that national security would be endangered if trials were held. What they don't want to consider is that this type of justice can endanger the liberty